Welcome, friends, to the Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett, and tonight we are talking to Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, who is usually scheduled to be on Mondays. Today is Tuesday, February 28th. We missed last night's, so we'll do it tonight or this morning for Bob. So, Bob, thanks again for rescheduling, and thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. I'm sorry I missed, but I haven't missed many in the last 20 years.
Absolutely not. I don't think you've missed a single one with me yet, anyway. So,
I've got people I've been on with for 20 years. I've never missed one.
More than can be said for me. So,
Pastor Butch and Stan Monteith and Erskine, never missed one.
Absolutely. Well, it's good to have you here.
That was in my younger days.
Back when you were young and sprightly like myself. So speaking of which...
Yeah, well, now I'm old enough to be a great-grandfather.
Well, I don't know about great. All right, well, let's start this off with a blast. And, of course, there is the never-ending circus in Europe going on. And some have likened it to a three-ring circus that stayed in town for 1 month too many. But what's the latest on the latest developments in Europe?
Well, I think you have to stretch your arm out and swing backward into the arms of antiquity. And that would be in 1990, 91, 92, when they put this whole dreadful thing together. The European Union was bad enough, and of course there were precursors to that, the iron and steel trade union, and then after that came the European Common Market, and then of course we ended up with the European Union, which I call an unnatural association. You might call it breeding a fish with a pig. Absolutely impossible. But they had to go ahead with it. They, being the bankers and the people who controlled Europe in half a century, and they want world government, and they don't care what the cost is, or the costs are, I should say. And they've done all sorts of illegal things, some of them criminal, in the course of time. And one of the things that really scares these people who are in control, particularly in Europe, is in the election coming up in April, Mr. Samaras and the New Democratic Party, if he wins, says he's going to investigate the government going back to 1974, which would include Mr. Papandreou's father as well as himself, Andreas Papandreou, who was probably in Greek history the worst crook in political office ever. With that said, I think that's a great idea. And you can find out who stole all the money and take it back from them. Now, of course, if you can catch them. And, of course, they're all tied up with the bankers, and the bankers will try to hide their wealth for them. But maybe that won't work. Because once this... the Eurozone and the European come down, and I think eventually they will. And it won't take too long, maybe 3, 5, 6 years. All of these bankers and the troglodytes who walk along with them, they are going to be in serious trouble. And the very nexus, the very heart, the very key to their power is banking. And if they lose that key, I mean, they might become waiters someplace or clerks or whatever. And they're not going to like working for the unwashed masses very much. And so maybe some of them will take their own lives, which I believe they will. I've been hearing rumors on this exposure by Lord Halifax, the biggest scam of all time, in the trillions, and I understand some of the banking royal families, we'll call them that, have been committing suicide I haven't heard much about it, but that's the rumor. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But it would be an easy way to get rid of them and expose what they've been doing. You got to remember that this power that these people have goes back for centuries. And this is nothing new. And not being able to understand the history of these people and what they've done, it is very difficult to come to the kind of conclusions which are very positive in solving that problem. And that's what most writers and commentators miss. They don't understand. They've never studied that. And it is a very arcane subject. There's absolutely no question. And very few people historically have ever taken the time to trace these people and what they've done. And that's really wherein lies the problem. Everybody's ignorant of what they're up to, what they're really up to. Well, with that said, we can cross over into the question, what's going to happen in the short term? Well, first of all, we're hearing noises from the cabinet in Germany and the German government that they're thinking of offering Greece a bailout to get out. We don't want to deal with you anymore. And I think the reason why is I think the Germans have finally come to the conclusion that it'd be a lot cheaper. And from their point of view, business-wise, who cares about Greece anyway? And on the other hand, the bankers don't want that because it cuts into their power base. It allows the politicians to be able to say and do things that the bankers don't want them to do, and the bankers are paying them. So we've also had several other statements. I mean, even Mrs. Merkel the day before yesterday said, well, you know, the whole thing isn't 100% yet. And so you say to yourself, well, what does that mean? It means that we don't know if there's a deal or there isn't. And so you have the election coming up in Greece, and I think the date is April the 3rd unless they change it again. And that's, what, a month away, more or less. And if Mr. Samaras gets elected, will he throw what the Greek government has just made in the way of a bailout out the window? Probably. Will he default? Maybe. Can Greece, even with bailouts, avoid default? Absolutely not. Just like the U.S. can't, and England can't. And the rest of Europe can't, because Germany and Holland and Finland, the strong parts of Europe, they get dragged down with everybody else eventually. So that's what we get coming in the cards. That's why they continue to suppress gold and silver prices as much as they can. And the reason why is the negative connotations of what's gone on for the past 3 or 4 months have been really, really strong. Gold should be selling for $3,000. It's not, because of the United States government, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a subsidiary of the Treasury Department. The other ones who are doing this, and they do it legally. But were we to get Ron Paul elected, it wouldn't be legal anymore, perhaps, probably. And maybe that would bring an end to a fascist government. But anyway, at the moment, the only saving grace for Europe is that the Federal Reserve has lent, they call it a currency swap, but it wasn't, it's a lie. And we don't know the total number yet. for this time, this time being the third week in December, and then today. What is the figure going to be? I figure about 1.2 trillion, maybe as much as 1.6. 523 banks have already gobbled up most of the initial amount of money, and banks are as far away as the Royal Bank of Scotland. They want a piece of it because they can buy cheaper there, buy money cheaper there, save themselves about $600 million. The whole thing is crazy. And so they think this pure sea of money is going to save them. And it's not. It's going to buy them time, but it's not going to save them. Will they have wars in between, new ones? Well, of course they will. Will it be Iran? I don't know. I know that Mr. Putin and Zbigniew Brzezinski are very concerned about a war over Iran because they say you don't want to be there if it happens. And they're talking about nuclear war. So are the bankers insane enough in America and in England, the Anglo-American grouping? Are they crazy enough to incinerate the world? Could be. I mean, you just never know with these people. I mean, you go back in history and see some of the things that they've done. You know, you can't say, how can any human being do such a thing? Well, it's a good question. Other human beings. So, with that said, really nothing has been accomplished in Europe except a degeneration and lots of money for the time being. That money should last them about a year and a half. Then they'll need more. So they'll print more. There's no way out for them. That's the only solution. And it isn't a solution. It's a stopgap, so to speak. And they'll continue to do what they're doing until they can't do it anymore. And then they're all going to get caught and go to jail and lose their fortunes. Finally.
Well, one would certainly
hope. And finally, maybe the public will wake up.
Yeah, well, that's what we're aiming for. And when you talk about the ways that they've backed themselves into a corner with all their different schemes and that there's no way out for them, it does sound so promising in so many different ways. But unfortunately, that does bring to my mind the idea of a cornered animal. And as you say, they do have their fingers on the nuclear buttons. And we know that they have no compunction about really anything that they're doing. So unfortunately for me, their downfall represents something of a danger as well. I mean, I'd like to see them all go to jail and do justice for what they've done, but I'm not sure they would ever willingly go there, especially not only with the nuclear option, but now with their genetically engineered monstrosities that are overpopulating the earth and all the other things that they've set upon us. There's some very, very dark things going on right now, and I'm not sure it can just be turned off with a flip of the switch.
And I think you're right. You know, I was thinking this morning, and I was telling Judy, who happens to be my wife of almost 50 years, we had an article on the drug companies not being paid by countries who are financially behind the eight ball, Greece and Portugal and Spain, or it's in the next issue. I have it in there. It's a link to an article. And, you know, you look at the pharmaceutical companies, as dreadful as their record is, and the things that they've done just to make money, you have to say to yourself, well, if the pharmaceutical companies don't get paid, maybe they won't stay in business. And then if they don't stay in business, all of those important drugs to keep lots of people alive won't be produced anymore. So you got to say to yourself, and I hate to say this, but are they too big to fail? It's a good question.
It is. It's a very good one, and I hope it's not rhetorical. I mean, what do you think?
Oh, we can't allow them to go under. It affects the whole world. I mean, if a drug company makes a drug, it's distributed throughout the world. I mean, you know, it's in different languages, but it doesn't make any difference. you know, doctors are trained from the same base. They're influenced by the same drug companies worldwide. And that's the way it's been for a long time. How do you separate it? Well, you know, the drug companies make an average of 18% a year and have for years and years and years. And then you got to look at who are the main people who are the shareholders of these companies. And you start with Rockefeller, Rothschild, all the foundations. And this is how they get a great deal of their money, through their cross holdings in these drug companies. And then they take the money, which is tax-free, and they use it to promote their ends. And that's been a giant source of funding for the Illuminus for a long, long time. And it's very, very important to them. So, as far as they're concerned, the drug companies can't go under, and the profits can't fall. You know, for these people, these Illuminus, this is like having secret funding, like a, you might call it a black source of funding, because most people don't know this. I know it because I was in the brokerage business for years, and you look at earnings and you see how they come about, and then you look at the shareholder list, and now you know why they make money the way they make it. 18% a year is a lot of money. You know, most companies make between, well, if you take the retail trade and supermarkets, it's like 2 or 3%. But the average is probably 10 or 11 or 12, and that's high. And so having monopolies, and essentially in some ways that's what they've got, because, you know, you see the generics come due and they say, well, we're going to extend you another 10 years or something. I mean, that's wrong. But they do it anyway because they have the power to do it, because they buy almost everybody in Congress.
Well, while we're on the subject of mysterious black sources of money and astronomical sums, why don't we return to that Lord James of Blackheath speech that you mentioned earlier that's been passed around quite a lot in the last week or so, where he was in the House of Lords in the UK, and it's in Hansard's, and you can watch the video where he's talking about some secret documents that he received showing transactions, apparently through HSBC to the Royal Bank of Scotland, three transactions for $5 trillion each for a total of $15 trillion. And apparently this is supposedly money that's supposedly in the hands of someone named Johannes Riadi, who is apparently funneling this for the Federal Reserve because he has cut some sort of secret deal with them not to cash in his worthless trillions and trillions of dollars of bonds for this money. It's a really elaborate, really bizarre tale, and I have absolutely no idea what to make of it, and I would probably dismiss it other than for the fact that it was in the House of Lords, so there must be something to it. But again, I'm not really sure what, if any, we can take away from this story, other than this is the type of dealings that maybe go on at the highest levels that we never really get a glimpse of.
Well, HSBC and the Royal Bank of Scotland are owned by the Queen of England, especially the Royal Bank of Scotland. How I know that is I had a friend who lived in Latin America whose nephew was the president of the Royal Bank of Scotland. She laid it all out for me. She was Scots, actually. And the poor soul contracted Alzheimer's disease, a brilliant mind this woman had. I used to play tennis with her all the time. But anyway, the ownership is there with the royal family, and 40-50% of HSBC is owned by the royal family. Now, these are the things you never see exploited or mentioned to the public. So you can understand why money flows from here to there and nobody knows about it, because they do what they want to do. They do anything that they want. And of course, the Royal Bank of Scotland went bankrupt, but they didn't say that. think it's so Wicket's financial problems, and they were assisted by others in making themselves whole, and maybe part of this money that we're seeing flowing, St. James of Heathrow, is it, or
what is his name again? James of Blackheath.
Blackheath. Well, I don't know where Blackheath is. I'm not current with that one. But I think what you've said is extraordinarily significant. The very fact that this man, who's probably about my age, has gone with his reputation and exposed these things in the House of Lords, which is appointed by the Queen. And maybe that's not the way it works, but anyway, it amounts to that. For him to do that is a death sentence. But there's something to it. We don't know exactly what it is yet.
Well, that's the point for me, because certainly I think anyone who was genuinely blowing the whistle out of turn on something like that probably wouldn't have gone that far even. So I know there must be something more to this story, but from this level, it's just impossible to really see that particular tree through all the forest.
You know, that's a kind of event that's untoward. It's like a cyclone. You never know it's coming until it gets offshore. And you see it, you know, 100 miles away, and it's headed right towards your island. And this is that kind of thing. An event nobody, including the people who are involved, ever expected to happen. And this could bring the whole system down. And that's another reason why you can't wait to get dehydrated and freeze-dried foods and a water filter and protection, gold and silver coins, bullion and shares. You've got to be in them, because you never know when something's going to pop. And when it does, you know, it's happened before. It's brought down government and government and financial system after financial system. And historically, as long as bankers are allowed to continue what they're doing and use fractional banking systems, what we're looking at here is major trouble. And so you've got to prepare yourself. And we really can't do anything about what's been done, because it's already an historical event. We may not know that because we don't know about it yet, if you can understand the double negatives. But the point is, there's something to this. Will it be covered up? Maybe. We'll have to see. But there's all, you know, there's so many episodes like this going on. And obviously, if the money is flowing from the Fed and was created by the Fed, they just didn't want to let anybody know. And they're siphoning it into other banks to save their historical system.
Well, while we're on this rather fascinating topic, it's a bit salacious and speculative, but still nonetheless quite interesting. I find it interesting that there are still people out there who believe in things like the Forbes Richest People in the World list, which I made a mocking reference to recently to basically say that it's probably not the most reliable list on the planet. And I actually had someone email me to ask, where did I get my source of information? Who is more, you know, who could possibly be richer than the top people on the Forbes list? Or like Bill Gates or some of those minions that they parade out to the public. But on that topic, I mean, what types of wealth are we talking about when we start talking about the people behind the scenes?
This shows you the ignorance of intelligent people. You go back into history and you can trace the whole thing. And it's not easy. And you have to be a scholar to do it, or make yourself into one. And what you have to look at is the accumulation of wealth. Can you identify who owns what? What the British royal family has done for centuries is set up all of these offshore corporations and corporate entities that show nobody owns it, but somebody does, and their names aren't on the charter, and so on and so forth. I do a lot of banking in Europe, and I know lots about that. And who are the richest? I don't know. But I know that the royal family in England and London are worth trillions of dollars. Trillions. The Medicis, the Count von Thurn and Taxis, who left us for the celestial life about 15 or 20 years ago. And he used to handle the finances for the Illuminis, you know, this overall alpha group. And when he died, they were thunderstruck. He was only 62 years old. And his wife was about 25 years younger, and she was a ditz. And she didn't know one side up from the other. She was an ex-model. And not that all models are dumb, but anyway. And finally, they wrestled all of the decision-making away from her and into the hands of their professionals. But there's families throughout Europe who stretch back into the 10th and 11th century that you can identify their evolution of wealth, you know, through financial dealings as well as wars. I mean, if you really study the history of the House of Windsor, you will find that in the mid to late 1400s, that house was taken over by the people who now call themselves the House of Windsor. They weren't the originals. These were people who came in 1348 who were kicked out of Italy, Venice, during the great financial collapse of 1348. And it didn't take them 100 years to take over the House of Windsor and become the kings and queens of Europe, of England, excuse me. And that's the evolution of that house. People don't know that. In fact, people don't know much at all.
Very true, but I don't tend to blame people for that, because I think that people have been, unfortunately, had it engineered out of them and drilled out of them in some cases, and have really had the stuffing knocked out of them by all of the various poisons that were being fed on a daily basis, both mental and physical. So I don't like to blame the victims for this. I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind who is really doing this and why people have reached the nadir intellectually that they have.
Well, I was pointing towards those like you and I who have had the opportunity and haven't taken it to discover, and they have the ability to do so, what really went on. And I think there's two reasons why they do that. Number one, they want to be thought well of by their peers, and they don't like getting dead.
Well, that's pretty blunt, but probably a pretty fair assessment of the psychology.
I see it in the newsletter business all the time. Some of these people know exactly what's going on. They won't talk about it.
Well, that's fundamentally what the real game is about. It's between the people who are aware and are going along with it and the people who are aware and aren't going along with it. And there's a vast mass of people in between who have absolutely no idea what's going on and probably never will. So it's the question of how to get around that mass and to the people who are actually, who you can actually affect change on.
I think you're right. The others don't have time or ability to do and look into those kind of things. So they're going to have to take our word for it. And unfortunately, a lot of them don't, because they believe what they see in the media, which is propaganda. And so they're happy to be able to accept that. And that's okay. You know, God made us all different. And, you know, why is somebody born with 185 IQ and somebody else with a 90? I mean, maybe when we get to heaven, we'll discover that. But in the meantime, there's nothing fair about life. I mean, some people get enormous head starts on others. And so I accede to your idea. But this is the soft underbelly that exists. And I've talked to some of these people extensively. They didn't know I knew who they were, what they were doing, what their history was. They had no idea. And so I get a lot of information other people don't get. I've always lived outside the box. And I've got a very inquiring mind, and I want to know, well, why did you do that? And then you find out. You know, it's just like in the Middle East right now, the sale of oil by Iran is going to denigrate the petrodollar. And that's really the basic of what it's all about, their financial system. And they have a choice here. Are they going to go after Iran? I don't think so. The more I look at it, when I saw Zbigniew Brzezinski talk about the absolute horror of what will happen if Iran is invaded. Now, this is the guy that planned this whole thing. This is not somebody making a comment like me about what's going on. I mean, he knows. And he's decided that, hey, wait a minute. Hey, I don't think this is a very good idea. There may be no world left.
Well, absolutely. But the thing about Brzezinski is that he's been arguing that for several years now. And he went in front of some sort of Senate subcommittee a few years ago, back during the Bush administration, to basically say the Iran war you guys are planning and talking about is going to be a complete disaster. And he basically all but said that I know you're going to try to stage something and we have to be on the lookout for something, some sort of fake justification. Not because Zbigniew Brzezinski is some kind of great guy, but because he's all about manipulating countries from behind the scenes and trying to get Iran fighting with China and China fighting with Russia and getting them to fight each other instead of fighting them directly. So I think it's more of a strategic thing from his perspective, but certainly his Machiavellian machinations just never stop.
Well, you're right about that. But I think he's been very serious about this. And I think it's one of the reasons why they've backed off on it over and over again. I mean, don't forget, the Ayatollahs were put in power in 1979 by these same people. And so the question, obviously, for a counterintelligence operative has to be, well, whose side are they on? I mean, do we, the CIA and MI6, do we still control the Iranians? Well, I don't know that. But the possibility exists. And Brzezinski, in back channel, would be saying, hey, you control these guys. You can control whether we have a war or not. Don't. It's not going to work.
Well, that's some fascinating perspective, because obviously you're speaking with your own experience and having done espionage and intelligence back in the days of the old Soviet menace. I mean, what was it like for you finding out that the Soviets were basically, I mean, it was part of the system that had been engineered by the globalists and the Illuminists all behind the scenes, that it wasn't the story that the people were being told about the evil empire facing down the Americans or whatever. It was really more of a dialectic that was being created. I mean, from your perspective as someone who was putting his life on the line for that type of espionage and things, I mean, what was it like to discover that that all those games were being played backstage?
Well, it started with my early discovery upon entering their ranks that the Second World War was a laydown, and that we had in part financed the two Axis powers, particularly Italy and Germany. And we let the fleet sit essentially unattended. I got the carriers out of Pearl and set up so the Japanese could bomb it, because we knew they wanted to bomb it anyway. Now, I said to myself, these people are worse than the mafia. And so I really don't want to do this. And the next 3 years I did that. And I certainly didn't stay on. They were quite upset about it. And still are to this day, as a matter of fact. As far as the machinations, it used to be a joke that we would pick up analysis and traffic and things like that, and we'd send it on a landline to Frankfurt and the hub of operations for counterintelligence in Europe during the 1950s, and after that, for that matter, was with the group in the IG Farben building, which incidentally never got bombed during the war. That's a real good one, like the GM plant near Kuhn. But all the traffic, all the analysis, all the code breaking went by landline. And, of course, if somebody broke into the landline, you knew it right away. So it was unacceptable, accessible. And they take it and put it in the bag and hop on a plane and head to wherever they were going, London, New York, Washington, and usually Washington, and to NSA, and Langley, and which is the other subsidiary, the Central Intelligence Agency, and they would go over the analytical work. The big joke was it would get into the U.S., and it would be in Moscow the following day. I said to myself, you got to be kidding me. And so your faith in the system naturally would crumble. You wouldn't have any respect for the system anymore. And, you know, different things like we knew who they were and they knew who we were. And on holidays, they'd go get drunk. No, we didn't do that. If we did, we didn't do it on the job. And they would send us our name, rank, serial number, and where we worked and what we did and who we copied and what intelligence we gathered, who was doing the analysis. It was unbelievable. They're spying on us, as was our spying on them. So it shows you how intensive the whole thing was. And they had a deal between the Russians and the U.S. You don't kill our guys and we don't kill yours. Unless there's some special occasion or something like, you know, we got somebody in what was then Eastern Germany and they were setting up radio transmitters and the Russians caught them. Well, they'd have to fight to get out. You know, whether Western Germany was 3 miles away. And there was no brick wall. I mean, you drove from one place to the other, like it was all the same place. And so, but other than that, there were no killings going on. Most people don't know that. And so you got to say to yourself, well, how come if the Russians and the Americans are at each other's throats, why are they making such deals?
Well, that's exactly the point, right? And certainly as the 50s slipped into the 60s and obviously Eisenhower became aware of what was going on and JFK, and there were more and more overt attempts to scuttle any sort of backdoor diplomacy that was trying to bridge mend the bridges or mend the fences or whatever that phrase is. And we have the U2 incident with Gary Powers, where all indications are that was basically set up to happen so that would cause an incident. And all sorts of things that, again, just get sort of elided in the flow of history. But it's really fascinating to take a look back at those incidents and see how there really was that growing military-industrial complex that Eisenhower alluded to, which obviously was being puppeteered through the banksters, that was truly playing both sides of the game, as they always do.
That's right. And he couldn't do anything about it. He made one reference that I know of to, and that was it. Because he was in mortal fear of his life. I mean, you know, how far can you go without getting killed?
Well, I think we found out on November 22nd.
That's Jack Kennedy, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So he had to be careful, and he was crafty at that sort of stuff. He was a good office manager, we'll call him. And most people have never read it. The book came out in 1948-49, War in Europe, I think it was, by Dwight Eisenhower. And it'll give you a good idea of a, how would you call it? A book that explained the war, but everything in there was in there because they allowed it to be in there. And all of the good stuff isn't in there. And fortunately, since that war, many others have written about it, and there's a lot of other books about it. But I read that book in French class, and you know how excited I was about French when I was about 15 or 16 years old. And so, you know, those are the kind of things that people have to look into in order to understand. And there are people who spend their whole lives just studying that period. But unless they get books that have been published outside the box, then they're not really going to get the true story. And, you know, there's different factions behind the scenes, and they have their own territorial imperative. And but they're all working through toward the same thing, total control of everything.
Well, that's what the game's all about, isn't it? And certainly, if you don't go outside of that box, and if you don't get that information from somewhere else, you're absolutely missing out on so much. And I guess we can certainly at least go back to Non Dare Call It Conspiracy, and that would be a touchstone for, I think, many people who owe so much of their understanding of the world from that seminal work, which you obviously had your own part to play in. And perhaps we can save that for another conversation, which I would very much like to have about Gary Allen and his works. But at any rate, perhaps we can start winding up this conversation by telling people about how they can read about contemporaneous and ongoing current events from outside the box by getting their hands on the International Forecaster.
Well, the Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. And we publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays by email. Runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the Internet. And everything that you need to know every week is in that publication. You can get a free copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, forecaster.com, or to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who would like to ask a question, we answer everyone, and almost nobody else does answer anybody, so we are very, very different than others. Would you like to get a copy of the publication, either of them? Or if you'd like to get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, you can email us, and that address is Bob, B-O-B, at I-N-T, F-O-R-E, C-A-S-T-E-R.com, Bob at intforecaster.com. And I almost lost my phone there. For those of you who would like to call in toll-free, you can go to 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. You can get copies of the publication. And for those of you who want to become subscribers, that's the place to go to. They have a special deal there, and you can get a full one-year free subscription. All you have to do is talk to them about the deal that they're offering. It's really terrific. it was something that you would do anyway. And so with that, I'm finished.
We'll leave it there, yeah. Well, you're a better man than me, Bob, because I'm sure I get 1/100th of the amount of email you get, and I still can't respond to it all. So my hat's off to you for that monumental effort.
Well, those people who only get a one-liner, you've got to understand that I'm not Superman.
I really hope so. Well, at any rate, I'm very much looking forward to next week. So until then, Bob Chapman, thank you so much, and take care.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.